we're in Revelation 17, and we are, we just got to a new, shorter vision than the one we just came out of. But this will take us to the end of chapter 21, basically. It'll take us to chapter 21, to Revelation 21:8, specifically, which is the verse that is referenced when I was in youth camp of Revelation 21:8, liars go to hell, along with a number of other things that go to hell, but liars go to hell. I remember singing the song when I was a kid. It was always a really pleasant one for people to hear, because it was like, burn, burn, burn. Because you know how kids are at camp. But but that's how I've always remembered Revelation 21:8, that it's a list of people who will find their place in the lake of fire. Well, this vision is a shorter version, or a shorter vision of what of another. Basically, this is a third vision, and read as a whole, the theme is striking and obvious. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I would encourage you to sit down and read 17 through 21:8. 17:1 through 21:8 in one sitting sometime, just to read it and see, because you will see that there is a glaring theme that is there. Two women in start of 17 symbolize two cities. So we're going to see that as we go on. The first is the lewd prostitute, which is Babylon the Great. The second is the pure bride, and that's the New Jerusalem. You're referencing two cities, which could be Rome. Basically, it's the New Jerusalem and the not New Jerusalem references that we get here. But the first is the finest product of human technology and achievement, one final terrible display of civilization apart from God. And the second is the finest product of divine grace, the eternal flowering of God's people. So that's what we see here. Sandwiched between John's view of the two cities is the coming of the bridegroom and the wedding party. And that is chapter 19, verses 6 through 10. And so in no way should we think of this vision as later than the events that John has already seen in chapter 12, 14, and 15 through 16. In other words, this is a different vision of the same passage, or a different passage and a different vision of the same event is more or less kind of what we should look at when we think about this. The vision of the two rival cities paints the same story of the end of the age with different images and changed perspective. In other words, what it honestly looks like when you look at the book of Revelation is John has been shown a couple different visions of the same event. In other words, we want you to see it from all angles. We want you to see it. It's like, I want you to see this in a way that it will be made clear and abundantly clear when it's all said and done. So you see John almost looking at a similar thing. So that brings us to the first part of chapter 17. Chapter 17, verses 1 through 6, we see a story here of essentially Babylon. And it says, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, and whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. Now, I'm going to read verse 7, but I'm not going to go into detail about verse 7 just quite yet. But verse 7 says, "But the angel said to me, 'Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of this woman, of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns.'" The reason I'm reading verse 7 is because of the question that's asked. He says, "Why did you marvel?" In other words, there is a warning in that verse, and we will get to that. But the marveling doesn't make sense to the angel. He said, "Why are you marveling at this? Why are you seeing this and you're going, and you're just in amazement at this circumstance and situation?" In other words, it's almost like when we look at the world today and we think, "Wow, why do we marvel at the world around us today? Why are we surprised at what is taking place?" I think that's the angel's way of John saying to John, like, "Look, we've already shown you all this. Why are you surprised? We've already, like, you're missing this. We've already shown you every bit of this. Why are you shocked? Why are you surprised?" So verses 1 and 2, "The last great city of civilization is portrayed as an extravagant, drunken prostitute riding on the Antichrist beast." In other words, the beast now has a rider, and it's a drunken prostitute. Sounds like a pretty fun image, right? I mean, to avoid any kind of conversation, do not try to put somebody that you know on that beast and make that your image. Yes, we all know somebody that would fit the description. No, we don't need to put them in that light mentally, or else we'll never look at him the same way. But we do need to understand the vision of a drunken harlot riding the Antichrist. That is the vision we're seeing here. The angel promises a view of the judgment of the harlot. So the angel is promising John, "You're about to see what is going to take place. You're about to see this judgment. You're about to see this take place. And with the information that this prostitute sits on many waters, she is in fact symbolic in nature. The original Babylon lay on the Euphrates River and had devised an elaborate system of irrigation canals." The original city of Babylon that we know of, scripturally speaking, sat on many waters. But the symbolism that's in this later, we find out that the waters are interpreted as a global thing. They are all the people and nations of the whole world. In other words, everything runs through Babylon. That makes perfect sense, to be honest with you. I mean, if we look at the world around us today, we are influenced by things that happen around the world, no matter where it happens anymore, right? Everything runs through Babylon. And so as we look at this and we think about this, in verse 2, she is described as "with whom the kings of earth committed fornication." This is where you see the world governments, the world leaders, everything compromising for one point of view. Again, I bring up certain social issues that we see in the world today. It becomes a national thing. The fornication with them would be compromising to certain things that people want you to do, so that you can, so that they won't bring you grief. Giving in to things. Basically, the harlot is the last manifestation of human culture as it exists apart from God. Which basically is what? Arrogant and independent. Human culture is arrogant and independent. We know that. We see it every day around us. Three words that basically sum the whole thing up is this: she is civilization. She is mankind. She is civilization. everything about the harlot, she is the world, mankind, civilization. She is that. That's the view we're looking at. And as such, she represents all that is corrupt within civilization. She represents the combination of politics and religion that flaunts justice and oppresses the majority of citizens. Not only are the leaders led astray morally, but the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. In other words, you buy in to the political point of view. You buy into this mindset that she carries with herself. And she promised her clients the pleasures of the world and the flesh, but she delivered the pain of drunken stupor. In other words, you become drunk on the promises, but then it's painful when it's all said and done. Because you become drunk on the promises, but you basically stumble over the drunkenness. There's not necessarily a fulfillment in the promises being made, or fulfilled for that matter, because there's still an emptiness left when it's all said and done. But you're basically stumbling through life, buying into the promises that politics and religion have now somehow tied together on. Verse 3, then John sees the woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which had 7 heads and 10 horns. That's familiar from the last vision, right? Because the beast is the same beast described in 13:1. So if we go and we start to put these two things together, the descriptions you get from 17 on are going to match up with descriptions you've already been given. In other words, the beast that had 7 heads and 10 horns is the same beast that she is now riding. And so the one that we identified as the Antichrist is the beast that the woman is riding. While the beast is described in 13:1 as having a blasphemous name on each of its heads, he is now described as having blasphemous names all over his body. In other words, it's the same beast, could be a little bit later, or it could just be that he only saw the blasphemous names on the head during the one vision. And now, as a better representation, they're all over the body. But that also represents the beast's complete rejection of God, symbolized by the extent of the tattoos, I guess, so to speak. Whether it's actual tattoos or just names, blasphemous, the beast is covered in blasphemy. And the woman is sitting on many waters is now described as sitting on the beast. You've got the names all over the beast. She's sitting on the beast. This simply means that she, Madam Civilization, we'll call her, the Babylon, the harlot, whatever you want to call her, is expressed in great cities, generally seduced all people, and that she moves forward with the help of this beast, or maybe a political force, or a government, whatever the case might be. The idea is spreading like a bee, like on the back of some force that has the power to kill God's witnesses. That sounds like a government. It surely sounds like a one world government that we talk about. Because when you have 7 heads of country and 10 crowns or 10 horns, so to speak, meaning that there may be others involved that come together to tear apart God's people, that's your beast. I mean, it could be as simple as that. It could be a literal 7-headed, 10-horned, flying purple people eater for all I know. I don't know. All I'm saying is, it sure seems to symbolically talk about a political movement of some sort that is being bought and driven to the entire world, and they're being seduced by the way she's carrying herself. I don't think that this is an accident. Another, and I don't have this in my notes, but another thing that I've heard before is that there are 7 letters to the churches. And it was a question asked, basically, of is it possible that the beast is the church? That it is the church that has bought into worldly ways in a way that the church is the one being seductive to the people, but riding on the beast rather than on the Savior. And it makes sense to have that question asked and say, is the church of the world, the church that is maybe headed by diadems or crowns or, so, you know, conventions, whatever, is it possible that the church buying into all these mindsets is overriding the one true church in seducing the world into thinking that they have everything they need? And when you see certain bodies of the church that buy into the worldly way and fornicate with the world in buying into the political jargon and saying, well, yeah, you're right, that doesn't need to happen, this equality, that equality, when it all comes down to, it's possible that they carry the names of blasphemy. I see the argument. I see the question. Is it the answer? I don't know. But it's possible. But then again, a lot of things are possible when you look at the book of Revelation, because we don't necessarily have it all laid out before us. Verse 4, though, in the first century, ordinary people were clothed with natural fibers that would appear to us as drab and dull. Basically, it would have been sackcloth, things like that. But dyes were expensive and could be afforded only by the wealthy. So, for someone to be wearing both purple and scarlet at the same time would have indicated they were very rich. The gold, the precious stones, the pearls are not inherently evil. Again, just like in the New Testament, where it's not money that's evil, it's the love of money that's the root of all evil. There's a difference in those explanations. Here they show the extravagant splendor of a wealthy prostitute. Later, the same elements will embellish the holy splendor of the heavenly bride. We do see that in chapter 21. But basically replacing the prostitute with the pure bride at the end. The golden cup full of abomination on the outside appeared splendid. It's a desirable gold goblet. The contents, however, are vulgar and repulsive. And ever since the Garden of Eden, forbidden fruit has looked beautiful, but has held the poison of sin and death. In other words, ever since day one, sin has lied on the inside of something that was very hard to resist. That absolutely is a tool of the devil. Think about the tree. You know, the knowledge of good and evil. It was obviously a fruit that was desirable for Eve to want to partake, whether it was symbolic or whether it was actual fruit. Whatever it was looked good to Eve. She took it. It was good. She went to Adam and said, here, you take. Adam didn't even need to be convinced. He's like, well, Eve took. Let's do this. I mean, it's a bad situation. But then verse 5, it says that on her forehead, a name was written. The name is written here. Well, let me go back to verse 4 for a second. There's a phrase in verse 4 of filthiness and her fornication, describing that which appears to be like delicious wine was in fact a vile death-inducing poison. In other words, what looks good on the outside is actually poison on the inside. But then the verse 5, on the forehead is written a 3-part title. The word mystery is deceptive. It's not a title. The mystery is explained beginning with verse 7. That's why I read verse 7 before I started the conversation. But then we are presented with her 3-part title. The phrase Babylon the Great appears in Revelation 4 times. verse 14:8, 16:19, 17:5, and 18:12. As a code name for a city, it was inspired by the city of Babylon in 6th century BC, but would have been tied to Rome, as I've talked about before. The form of Babylon present in the 1st century would have certainly been Rome, but just as ancient Babylon had murdered the Old Testament people of God, the new Babylon is murdering God's people. What we see in Revelation is a Babylon that is murdering God's people. How do I know that? Because she's drinking of a cup full of abominations. But it also tells us in verse 6 that she was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs. So in other words, this city is drunk on blood. It's a bloodthirsty harlot. There's other words to say it, but that's the nicest way I can say it. But the mother of harlots means the source of idolatry and evil. It's not necessarily sexually speaking, but she is the source. The city is the source of this idolatry and evil that is taking over the world. The mother of abominations of the earth finishes the secret name of the harlot. Whatever was detestable around the world issued from the great city. Anything that was detestable in the eyes of God started there. It started with her. This is where the government aspect of it shows up again. But as this madam civilization has proven to be the source of every conceivable human atrocity, which leads us to verse 6 and the last verse I'm going to look at tonight, and then the next time we'll talk about the interpretation that John is given, because he gets the meaning. This vision, he's actually given a meaning by an angel. So you get the vision, then you get the definition of the vision. But in verse 6, while the immorality and the idolatry of the prostitute city have been clear from the beginning of the vision, her hatred and murder of the people of God is now specified. In verse 6, it is laid out. There's no mistaking what she's being accused of and what she's drunk on. The beautiful whore now appears as a staggering drunk. Really no other way to put that. The harlot is a staggering drunk. And she's basically drunk from the blood that is dripping from her mouth. It's like she just cannot get enough. And she's so drunk that she's drooling it out. What is portrayed is an unrestrained slaughter of a great number of believers, along with the intoxicating effect it produces upon the murderer. If you've ever heard of a serial killer talking about the feeling they get when they commit a murder, if you've ever heard of anyone talking about that rush that they felt when they've committed those murders, anyone that does that on a regular basis, there's a serial killers talk about it a lot. If you've never heard it, go and watch a video of Ted Bundy or somebody talking about the effects of how that made them feel. The feeling of being alive, the rush that it gave them, the thirst for blood that became more of a thirst for blood, because after the one time, well, they want more. You know, it felt so good, they want to do it again, and then again, and again. It's sickening, honestly. That's truthfully what this is talking about. That's how Babylon feels. She's caused the demise so much. Now, if we're talking symbolically and figuratively, anytime you get your way, anytime that you murder God's people in a way that shuts down an idea, well, let's start with taking prayer out of school. The feeling that that group of people got when they accomplished the task. The feeling they got when they voted down or when a judge overturned an amendment in North Carolina. The feeling that people get when they realize that, you know, they're getting their way and it's a sinful way. But they have pride about it. They gloat about it. They become overwhelmed and they start pushing for more. This is why the offending thing has taken place. Now you're going 30 years back in time to charge somebody with something because, you know, maybe it was something they shouldn't have done. That's not for me to judge. But to be able to go back with no statute of limitations and prosecute something, this is getting to the point where things are ridiculous. That people can charge people with things just, well, he looked at me wrong. It's a thirst for blood. And it's something that is only going to devour human nature eventually. And that's something, I mean, even going back to an earlier conversation from tonight, that's the thing that's happening around us in the world today. And there's no stopping it because people are out for blood. And the blood's dripping from their mouths and they're just out for more. But up to this point, the woman seems to be triumphant, but her judgment is yet to come. And that leads us into the next part. But that's what we're looking at here. That being said, could you imagine why John marveled at what he saw? The fact that, let's just be real, we marvel at what we see every day. When we see this drunken prostitute who's dripping with blood from her mouth because she's so bloodthirsty. We marvel about the things we politically see in the world today. We marvel about the things that we just cannot for the life of us understand why these things are happening. How did the world get here? How did everything become what it is now? Sure sounds a whole lot like this situation right here. That John, the marvel, I think, is more, he basically says, I'll tell you exactly what you're seeing. And he asks him why he's marveling. And we'll go into all of that. But essentially, what we're looking at here, I wonder what John's marvel looked like. I wonder if John's marvel was his mouth wide open in complete awe that this is what the world has come to. Because if that's the case, we're a lot closer than we think we are. Because we all look at the world that way every single day. And we cannot, for the life of us, understand why the world is where it is.